From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Safe shelter, safe streets. We meet two Open Society Institute Baltimore community fellows who are working to improve city life. Ava Pipitone's app, Host Home, will quickly find shelter for transgender individuals in distress.
I actually don't know another trans person in Baltimore City who hasn't taken in another trans sibling for a couple nights in an emergency. We have been housing our own. What Host Home is doing is noticing that, scaling it up, and structurally supporting it.
And artist Graham Correll Allen will work with residents to re-envision access to Druid Hill Park so that pedestrians, cyclists, and people with mobility devices can safely travel to and enjoy this open space. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Housing and employment discrimination, unsupportive or abusive family members, those who identify as gender and sexual minorities may face extreme challenges when it comes to securing a stable place to live. The National Coalition for the Homeless estimates that one out of every five transgender or gender nonconforming adults has experienced homelessness at some point. Homelessness is even more dire for LGBT youth. The Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law found that 40% of homeless young people identify as gay or transgender. A new project called Host Home aims to tackle sudden homelessness by matching those in need of housing with those who can offer a safe place to stay. Ava Pipitone is co-founder of Host Home, former executive director of the Baltimore Transgender Alliance, and a recently named 2018 Open Society Institute Baltimore Community Fellow. The nonprofit Open Society Institute serves overlooked or neglected communities by supporting innovative community-based solutions. Ava, welcome to On the Record.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get involved in connecting people to emergency housing?
So I was a worker owner at Red Emma's Coffee House and Bookstore for about 3.5 years. And during that time, the space was very safe for people of different class backgrounds, race backgrounds, and different sex and gender minorities. So it was because of my position in that space that I could see homeless trans youth sharing coffee, playing chess with wealthy LGBT folks, and they couldn't see each other's identities, right? They didn't know the resources that were also in that space, in that community with them. And we had people that were in dire need in community with people who had excess resources. So I began to, take people in. Other friends were taking people in, and then as I hit capacity in that, started thinking more about boundaries, we started, putting our skills to work and actually matching people just on the fly. It was some Facebook groups, it was some Facebook group chats, it was some Excel spreadsheets, and then before we knew it, we were doing a better job in community matching people, housing people, than some of the programs that exist in the city. When we started getting phone calls from case managers asking us if we could place somebody, we knew we had to scale this up.
Well, why aren't shelters an option, or at least not always an option for folks?
Yeah. So I really appreciate the stats you mentioned in the beginning. Another factor when looking at a group housing situation, like a shelter or transitional home, is that according to the National Trans Survey in 2015, 70% of trans folks are attacked, harassed, kicked out, or worse in those situations. And for that reason, 26% of us don't even choose to go for those. Many of my community members, I think 1 in 5 trans people, have experienced homelessness during transition. How are we still here? We have been taking each other in. I actually don't know another trans person in Baltimore City who hasn't taken in another trans sibling for a couple nights in an emergency. We have been housing our own. What Host Home is doing is noticing that, scaling it up, and structurally supporting it.
So you do this with an app now?
Yes. What I like to say, think about these, matching apps. So like a dating app, for example, like Match.com. if Match.com and Airbnb, right, distributed housing for rentals, for vacation. So if Match.com and Airbnb had a baby that grew up to be the future of shelters, that's kind of what Host Home is doing. A fundamental nuance that these customers in the travel space have that a case in the nonprofit space doesn't. A customer in Airbnb or HomeAway, you know, you pay X amount of money, so you must be trustworthy. So here's the Wi-Fi password. Here's a towel. Here's the keys to the front door. How can we blur these lines between case and customer intentionally? In short, what if you could review your shelter and that review actually affected their funding? That's the power dynamic, right? Host Home isn't building anything. We are bringing an updated, community-grown upgrade to housing services, putting the power in the guests' hands.
Tell me why this review is important, because, is it not essentially donated housing?
Mm. So the way Host Home will come to maturity, right? To get there, first, we're looking at enterprise-level clients to build software for. So our first iteration of Host Home is software that we sell to the nonprofits in this space. It's a tool that facilitates emergency housing by ingesting all of their data and helping them close the gap. Because what people don't know, when you call a shelter, when a case manager calls a shelter for you, the average wait time is 14 days before you get placed. That is too slow. We are looking to build tools that allow people to do that labor of housing people in emergencies, do it better, do it faster. So after we have a couple clients, after we've ingested this shelter's data and built a tool for them, this shelter's data built a tool for them, and now they're housing people in much faster timelines, like 3 days, like 2 days. Then the app, because it's ingesting this data and learning and improving, and when one shelter has this amazing connection to funding or this trick that they're doing that allows things to run more smoothly, seamlessly any other customer at Host Home can integrate and roll out that same solution. So everything is simultaneous. So then the benefits of being in the Host Home app to facilitate your housing services become, you know, immediately updating, learning from what's the cutting edge in the sector, and also deploying training to your providers over the app. The next iteration will be increasing the access to actually running a shelter. So you can run a shelter, you know, with a smaller organization and still access the same funding streams because you have the same tool. And then iterations further and further, your spare bedroom can be structurally equivalent to a small-scale shelter and part of a mesh network of other bedroom-based shelters.
This is On the Record on WIP. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with OSI Baltimore Community Fellow Ava Pipitone. For the next year and a half, she'll further her project Host Home, which matches LGBT individuals in distress with a temporary housing placement. So we're talking about emergency housing. Mm-hmm. What about people with long-term housing?
Yeah, great. So I think we're not reinventing the wheel. I just say this a lot. We are not looking to replace the functions of full comprehensive care and support of a transitional housing program. We're looking to fill in that gap that I mentioned earlier, that two-week gap before people can even access a shelter. Because what people don't understand is during that 2 weeks, you're on a friend's sofa and no one in community should run out of friends with spare sofas. Your life shouldn't depend on that social capital.
How do you screen people who are offering to host someone?
Yeah, definitely. So in the future, when we're at that further iteration of the app, when it can be deployed in your own private property, we have an inverse relationship between hosts and guests. What I mean by that is only the most experienced hosts who have completed multiple training modules on the app, who have multiple positive reviews on their profile, will see a first-time guest. Inversely, a new host just joining us is going to see a guest who has multiple positive reviews.
Who knows what to expect.
Right. This is what the function of those early Facebook chat groups is, or was. Right? This is what word of mouth is. This is what people mean when they say word travels faster on the street than it does on Facebook, right? Because the system is looking to capture that kind of intangible vetting.
You ran a 2-month pilot mm-hmm. of Host Home. What did you learn?
Yeah. So a little over a year ago, we housed 20-some individuals for 75 nights with only 4 hosts and $1,200 raised. What did we learn? We learned a lot about levels of structural homelessness versus levels of, you know, first-time gaps in housing, right? So someone who might be coming out as transgender while away at university who comes home and experiences abuse from their parents and can't be there, where do they go? Versus somebody who is engaging in a survival economy and needs a lot more support. And, you know, that was a discovery concept pilot. And that level of, you know, we will have open arms is what everybody in community has. So in doing that, we realized things went most smoothly when myself and other people that were involved at the time thought very intentionally about how to place people. And as we started to break that down, there are patterns. There are patterns. And that's basically how we're building the algorithm.
Let me ask you briefly about mm-hmm. financing. I'm assuming that the first iterations you talked about, working with shelters, they already have some mm-hmm. some revenue stream, mm-hmm. some grants, whatever supports mm-hmm. them. But when you get to the point of individuals, you intend to pay the host, yeah. and that comes from what?
I think it's useful to highlight a pivot in the model. So this time in the spring, right, and, you know, a couple months back, we were operating under a social enterprise model. And that was, we would raise money through private philanthropy, individual donors, crowdfunding, fill up an account and pay hosts that we're running, right? That's great. We're generating a lot of data. We're actually having a strong impact. We're actually able to house like dozens of trans folks. Great. In the future, we are looking to reintegrate with existing funding streams. So as we build software for traditional shelters to use, they have their funding streams. But our software can streamline how they access it and lighten their load. So we're looking to use the existing funding streams these shelters are using, but allowing them to have more impact on it. And then as it expands and people can use it, you know, in their private home, they'll be able to integrate in with those same funding streams because Host Home can be the intermediary. So you and your bedroom are not, your guest room are not taking on all that risk. Now you are a satellite of this larger mesh network of hosts.
What do you expect we will learn about homelessness as Host Home gets up and running?
Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't notice the challenges of those in their community around them. People can be in the same online coding boot camp, learning how to do programming languages, and one person might be living on the street or in their friend's guest room, and the other person might be making 6 figures and working at a tech company, and they might be working on the same coding project together and meet up for coffee and still not be able to see the differences in their lives. We don't know what homelessness looks like. We think it looks a certain specific way, but I challenge that. And I think Host Home, for the first time ever, we'll be able to provide real-time data on homelessness in the United States. We actually only do 1 count per year, and we don't capture everybody. We definitely don't count people who are couch surfing, right? We don't count people who are unleased. So there's just a really big gap in the data. And Host Home will have new data on what homelessness looks like in real time.
Really interesting. Thank you for telling us about it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Ava Pipitone is a 2018 OSI Baltimore Community Fellow. Her project is called Host Home. There are 9 other fellows this year. Their projects include the Housing and Job Skills Program, Black Women Build Baltimore, and a leadership program for black male middle school students. We'll profile more of this year's cohort in the coming weeks. Quick break here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Baltimore's Druid Hill Park spans 750 acres. It's home to Druid Lake, the Maryland Zoo, tennis courts, outdoor exercise equipment, and the Rawlings Conservatory. The park is a green oasis in the city, but for some it's out of reach. Crossing multiple lanes of fast-moving traffic by wheelchair or on foot is too dangerous to attempt. Artist Graham Correll Allen aims to change that. He's a recipient of a 2018 Open Society Institute Baltimore Community Fellowship. The nonprofit Open Society Institute focuses on needs of Baltimore's underserved neighborhoods by supporting innovative projects driven by community members. For the next year and a half, Correll Allen will re-envision the public space around Druid Hill Park so that pedestrians, bicyclists, and people with mobility devices can safely get to the park. His project is called Druid Hill Complete Streets. Graham, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you.
I mentioned multiple lanes of traffic. Paint a picture for us of the barriers around Druid Hill Park.
Okay, so imagine this. A set of neighborhoods that were built around Druid Hill Park, you know, well over 100 years ago. These were two-lane parkfront residential streets. Every single side street used to branch out into a series of curvy linear pedestrian paths, providing upwards of 20 access points to the park for residents. Now, instead of these two-lane residential streets, instead we have 6 to 9 lane wide, fast-moving highways. And the once 20 access points have now been winnowed down to about 4 major intersections where people are permitted to cross the street.
What have you heard from residents about the challenges of accessing the park?
One of the things that I learned about when I first moved to the area in 2013 was that my neighborhood association, the Ocantrolley Terrace Association, had been working with DOT on trying to...
The State Department of Transportation?
Baltimore City Department of Transportation to come up with some traffic calming measures. And while they
traffic calming, tell me what that's a real planner's phrase, but it's not something ordinary people talk about.
Sure. Yeah. Traffic calming is a series of different types of kind of design and programmatic features that slow down cars. So imagine, for example, a speed bump. That is a way to slow down the cars and make a street safer for people to use and cross. As if one is struck by a car traveling above 25 miles an hour, it's more likely that you're going to die than live. And so really, we need to ensure that traffic is not moving faster than 25 miles an hour to protect the safety of our residents. The Neighborhood Association had successfully worked with the Department of Transportation on getting some speed bumps implemented around some of the kind of smaller neighborhood streets. However, they were unsuccessful at getting traffic calming devices, such as speed bumps or in other places, rumble strips, for example, to slow down the big highway traffic around the park. And now we're still left with several challenges. For example, in my neighborhood, Ocantrolley Terrace and Mondawmin, which is between Ocantrolley Terrace, Reisterstown Road, Liberty Heights, and Fulton, we do not have a playground. There is a playground, however, very close to the intersection of Fulton and Ocantrolley, right across the street in Druid Hill Park. So our kids have to run across, at that point, 10 lanes of traffic.
Oh my!
In order to reach the playground. In addition, during the warm months, we have a really fantastic farmer's market. It's the Druid Hill Farmer's Market, and it sets up right next to the Rawlings Conservatory. And it's really sad to see that several of my elderly neighbors are unable to make it to the farmer's market due to the fast-moving traffic and having to walk several blocks in order to find an intersection where it takes several traffic cycles for someone on foot to effectively and safely cross the street.
Several traffic cycles, meaning one green light to cross is not long enough in minutes for someone to walk across all those lanes of traffic.
Correct. Yeah. So if you're just a regular person attempting to cross the street, you might get 10 seconds heads up to start moving, which is enough time to cross the first three or four lanes of traffic. And then you're stuck in the median strip and you wait a whole nother cycle to then get another chance to continue crossing a subsequent five lanes of northbound traffic. And the residents that I've been meeting with and getting to know over the past 6 years, you know, have been really interested in seeing new ways to slow these cars down and create ways for us to safely basically cross the street, you know, in order to get to Druid Hill Park. And you asked about, you know, what does traffic calming mean? And traffic calming can mean a lot of different things. I mentioned a couple of things, you know, speed bumps and rumble strips, but those are sort of band-aids that are added after the fact. Instead, we have an opportunity now with a forthcoming major transportation study next year that's taking place, being led by the Baltimore City Department of Transportation, to rethink these streets from the ground up. And instead of putting band-aids on them, we can actually reconsider and redesign them entirely with additional intersections, perhaps narrower lanes, maybe even less lanes, and creating protected spaces for people who rely on wheelchairs, bicycles, and scooters to actually get around and safely connect with the park.
When will this study begin?
The study is slated to start sometime in late spring. At the moment, the Department of Transportation is still working on hiring the planning firm that they'll be collaborating with to conduct the study and what will amount to essentially a master planning effort for all the major roads around Druid Hill Park, including Druid Park Lake Drive and Occhentrolley Terrace.
That's Graham Correll Allen, a 2018 Open Society Institute Baltimore Community Fellow, whose project is called Druid Hill Complete Streets. So how do you plan to get more community input into this study?
Absolutely. So one of the things I'm really excited about is using my skills as a public artist and also as a tour guide. In fact, I've been leading tours since 2008 of public spaces around the city. My tours are about the history, design, and uses of public spaces, with a particular focus on resident voices and how residents have been affecting change in their neighborhoods. So I'm really excited to extend this planning process so that it's not just a series of meetings in, you know, community rooms, for example, at hours that may be difficult for people to attend, but instead have those meetings in the evening after work, for example. But also, let's do meetings outside of rooms. Let's have gatherings at the farmers market where we can hear directly from folks who maybe aren't always inclined to go to a community meeting, but would be happy to share their views on connecting with the park at the farmers market or at a concert or at a fellowship hall, for example. In addition, I'm going to be leading different thematic tours co-led with residents, focusing on the experiences of different groups, including youth, elderly, and people with disabilities.
And what role does art play in this? You say you're a public artist.
This is the other kind of half of my life, is I create installations for pedestrian safety and play. And so I try to use creative approaches to adapting public spaces and streets to make it easier for people to use them and also to celebrate and reflect local culture. With this planning process, once we have a plan in place, it's still going to take many years for our elected officials to go and secure the amount of money necessary to actually fund construction. In the meantime, during this fellowship period, I'm really excited to collaborate with my neighbors and local youth to affect change now through traffic calming public art. For example, artistic crosswalks, which highlight the presence of pedestrians to passing motorists and remind motorists that when pedestrians are walking with the signal, they indeed have the right of way.
So what is an artistic crosswalk? I'm trying to envision it.
Sure. Imagine a crosswalk that's filled in with a bright colored mural. A mural that could be represented.
A mural on the pavement.
A mural on the pavement. So instead of having just two white parallel lines, imagine the space between those two lines filled with all sorts of bright colors so that it really pops out. And it could also represent different symbols or, you know, imagery that is reflective of our communities.
What's the timeline for your project?
So this is an 18-month fellowship, but I've been doing the work for years already, and I'll be continuing to do the work after this fellowship. As it stands, I'm in the process of continuing to meet with additional stakeholders. Starting at the beginning of 2017, our councilman, Leon Pinkett, convened a group of stakeholders from around Druid Hill Park, representative of Auchentrally Terrace, Mundaman, Reservoir Hill, as well as other institutional partners like Parks and People, as well as the city agencies. And I want to continue to meet with more residents, more community leaders to bring more voices to the table so that once that planning study does begin in late spring, everybody is ready to go and has their respective communities mobilized and prepared to participate to ensure that, once again, this study is as reflective of community voices as possible. And then towards the second half of 2019 and then spring 2020, we'll be creating these different types of artistic crosswalks, perhaps protective planters, or maybe even creative signage all around these neighborhoods to remind motorists of the needs of all the other residents who seek to enjoy and take advantage of the many amazing assets we have in West Baltimore.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Graham Correll Allen is an artist and a 2018 OSI Baltimore Community Fellow. His project is Druid Hill Complete Streets. There are 9 other OSI Fellows this year. Their projects include a green space and bird tracking project and a legal assistance program for students facing suspension or expulsion. You can find profiles of other OSI Fellows at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're listening. On the Record. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.